You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we'll have a conversation about permaculture here on People Rise Up. Good morning. You're listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller, and we're going to have a very practical and positive show today, as opposed to the sometimes more abstract and upsetting type of information that I provide to you. I find it's good to have a mix. And for those of you who already like to garden, although it's not exclusively the context in which we'll be talking about permaculture today, but for those of you who like to garden, you'll especially enjoy this, I hope. Joining me here in the studio this morning, I have Toby Hemenway. He's author of Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture, which came out a couple, 3 years back. Welcome to our airwaves, Toby.
Good morning, Andrew. Good to be here.
Thank you for coming. Toby is actually a resident now of the area and is participating in the Village Building Convergence 5 this evening at Sunnyside Environmental School, which is at 34th and Southeast Salmon. And he'll be part of a presentation this evening joining Joe Kennedy talking about natural building, and I guess you'll be talking mostly about permaculture beginning at 7 or so.
That's right.
So, let's get to it. Permaculture. I found kind of a mix. I found no definition for it, and then I found a lot of definitions for it. So, how would you explain permaculture to folks who know nothing about it?
Well, the little soundbite is that it's the art and science of integrating people sustainably into their landscape, but that's kind of hard to figure out exactly what that means. So the way I like to describe it is that if you think of things like organic gardening and solar energy, appropriate technology, even things like consensus decision making and social justice, if you think of those as tools, then permaculture is the toolbox that helps organize all those tools and helps you decide when and where to use them and how to use them most appropriately.
Now, when I've actually studied permaculture just a little bit, and I'd like to do more. My perception of it ahead of time was that it's plant-oriented, it's agricultural-oriented, garden-specific type of system, permaculture being short for permanent agriculture, in one sense, sort of the contraction, but that's not really the case. It's much broader than growing plants, right?
Yeah, it is. It got started as permanent agriculture, as you said, but it's really evolved to mean permanent culture. When it began, the founder, Bill Mollison, and his graduate student, David Holmgren, down in Australia, were really looking at ecosystems, and they were wondering, you know, how can we design human ecosystems that have the stability and the resiliency and the productivity as well as the beauty of natural ecosystems. So they were looking more at, you know, plant-based, plant and animal, the wild world. How can we do the things that nature does so effectively? And what they did was to kind of extract a set of principles from nature that we use as design tools to help us design sustainable landscapes. So it got started as kind of plant-based because they were kind of food fanatics. They were very interested in gardening, and of course, agriculture is at the heart of any real civilization. But as they spent more and more time figuring out what permaculture was and figuring out how to apply it, they realized that food is only one component of having a sustainable society, and you really need, you know, types of buildings that are eco-friendly, and then beyond that, you need a social system that will support that kind of thing. So it's gradually grown from beyond just gardening to include something we call in permaculture invisible structures, which really are the things you can't see that organize your society, like politics and religion and law and economics, as well as gardening, too.
And one of the features that I like most about permaculture is that the focus is not on, for lack of a better term, the things themselves. It's on how they interact and self-support. And the idea is to, and again, using agriculture as kind of the assumed sector in which this conversation takes place, you know, how do you design systems so that they take care of themselves? I saw a phrase, cultivated ecology, which I really like that as a concept.
Yeah, that's the idea. You kind of use nature as the instruction manual, since, you know, one of the things that I always notice is that I go into a forest and, you know, it looks great, and then I come back a month later, even if it hasn't rained, and the forest still looks great. But my own yard, you know, you go away for a month and you come back and it's either a jungle or everything's dried up and died. So, you know, the idea is, how does nature do that? And that's why we talk about cultivated ecologies. We're trying to put the pieces together in the right relationships so that they'll support one another. Permaculture is really a design approach. It's not so much a particular technique, although there are some techniques that are sort of special to permaculture, but it's really about putting pieces in the right relationship. A design isn't just what's in the design. You know, you can throw a bunch of stuff down, and that's not really a design, no matter how cool the individual parts are. It's how those parts are all in relationship to one another that makes a design beautiful, or makes it practical, or makes it self-sustaining.
So I have a great big long list here of permaculture design principles, and there's about three dozen of them, and we're obviously not going to be able to get to all of them, but I'd like to talk about some of these principles, and then we'll come back to something you just said about techniques specific to permaculture, and then we'll get into issues of how we can apply some of these things specifically in an urban environment, because I bet most of the people listening to my voice right now live in an urban environment. And these are not necessarily in any particular order, both how I present them and I think how they're listed here on the page. We already talked about the relationship between components, both in terms of function and, well, I guess they're both really in terms of function. Redundancy. We, I think, often think of redundancy in human systems anyway as a negative, unless there's some sort of like safety protection angle, like nuclear power plants. You want multiple redundancies in case something wrong happens. How does redundancy factor into permaculture design, and why is it good in permaculture?
Well, it really is about having backups in place. And one example you can think of is, you know, the way some people handle water conservation is they just install a drip irrigation system, something like that. And then, again, they go away on vacation. There's a power outage, or, you know, a gopher gnaws a hole through their hose or something like that. And, you know, their landscape is dead when they get back because they've relied on one system for doing that really important function of water conservation. But if what you had done instead was to build up the soil so there's a lot of organic matter in it, put some mulch down to keep things from getting hot and evaporating, and maybe even contouring the soil to hold rainwater a little bit better, choosing the right kind of plants so that, you know, they won't be quite as susceptible to drought, then you've got a whole bunch of systems in place so that if one of them goes bad, you know, the mulch blows away in a windstorm or something, you've got the others there in place to take care of the water conservation. Plus, besides just having those multiple systems all working together to support water conservation, you know, you add organic matter to the soil to hold water, and that's also going to help your fertility. The mulch will break down and add more nutrients to the soil. So you get all these side benefits when you put together these multiple elements to support that one function of water conservation.
And in addressing these, I'd just like to ask not to stick exclusively to agricultural type stuff. I know it would be really easy for both of us to just talk about the garden aspect of this, but I think showing and or mentioning to people that there's other things outside of the garden that these all apply to. So redundancy, diversity is sort of a companion to that, again, in the garden. But how could you address the issue of diversity in a permaculture system outside of a garden?
Sure. Well, I think there are a lot of ways to do it. And I'd like to bring in another principle that's probably on that list at the same time, which is the edge effect, that really interesting things tend to happen at the edges. You know, the ecology example is where a forest meets a meadow. There's really interesting things happening right at that interface. But if you think of diversity and the edge effect in an urban context, then, you know, the coolest music often happens where two cultures get together. You know, when African music meets Latin American music, it's very, very interesting. You know, when urban music meets bluegrass or something like that. So diversity, you know, I think that sort of speaks for itself, is instead of just one voice speaking, you'll hear lots of different voices, get a lot of different opinions. You know, if I'm the only one telling you what to do, you're only hearing my opinion, whereas if I facilitate a meeting where we get to hear everybody's opinion, obviously we're going to learn a lot more than just what I've got to say.
So the edge effect is sort of a democratic concept then?
Yeah, it really is. It's allowing the different edges to participate.
I'm pretty sure there's also been research that shows that it's at the edges where plants and animals exist that don't exist in either, assuming there's only two, either habitat by itself. It has to be at the edge.
Right, that's really it. You know, deep inside a forest, certain animals live, and in the middle of a meadow, certain other animals live. But where the forest meets the meadow, there are a bunch of species that only occur right there at that edge, as well as the forest and the meadow animals. So there's lots more diversity at edges, and culturally that holds true too.
Make the least change for the greatest effect.
Right. That's just the idea of learning what it is you're working with, kind of understanding, I'll give one garden example. You know, if you've got a problem with slugs, you learn about the slug life cycle and you figure out, well, they come out mostly at night. So if I go out to pick slugs off of my plants at night, that's going to be a lot more effective than going out during the daytime. Instead of doing a huge amount of work, you figure out where you can intervene the most successfully and with the least amount of work to make the biggest change. And the social example that I use for that sort of thing is unfortunately a negative example, but if you think of September 11th, you know, it was 19 guys and 4 airplanes, and it changed an awful lot. Intervening at a very weak point in our system really altered a huge amount of things. So they knew that principle.
And that's a different show altogether.
Yeah, you bet. Let's not go there.
The problem is the solution, I think, is a good companion to the make the least change for the greatest effect. How can the problem be the solution?
Right. Well, one example, again, from the landscape that I like, and it actually has a social context as well, was a friend of mine down in Tucson had really bad soil in their yard, and so they had some topsoil delivered. It turned out that the topsoil was badly contaminated with pesticides that had come from some cotton fields outside of town. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at this and said, you know, we don't want to garden in this. We're organic gardeners. We're not going to grow food in pesticide-laden soil. They lived on a really busy intersection with a lot of noise and no privacy. And they realized that if they took that soil and added some clay to it and maybe a little bit of cement and turned it into adobe blocks, which is the technology that people use down in Tucson a lot, they then built a wall around their corner, which stabilized the soil so it wasn't leaching pesticides into their yard, and it blocked the noise and it gave them a good privacy screen. So their problem of this toxic soil not only help them solve the problem of getting rid of the toxic soil, you know, how could they deal with that, but also help the privacy issue and the noise issue as well. So very often, if you look at a problem, you can see not only the seeds of its own solution in that problem, but very often you can solve several other problems at the same time.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest today is Toby Hemenway. He is author of Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture, and he'll be speaking this evening at the Village Building Convergence presentation, Sunnyside Environmental School here in Portland, 34th and Southeast Salmon, beginning at 7 p.m. He has a website at www.patternliteracy.com. That's all one word. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links both to Toby's site and all sorts of other permaculture-connected resources for you to check out. And that's what we are talking about this morning, permaculture. Let's talk about a few more of these principles, and then we'll get into how can we do some of this stuff here in a urban environment. These are ones that I see connecting together. Maybe these are grouped in a way on this list. The principle of disorder, the idea of entropy, and the idea of metastability. Do you see those as all connecting?
Yeah, I think they are. Human beings tend to we have a bizarre idea of order. A lot of the times if we look at roads or a landscape or a garden, we like things nice and straight and linear. We like things, we consider that to be really organized. And yet it takes a huge amount of work to create that kind of order. You know, if you look at nature, there are rarely straight lines.
There's nothing
there's nothing orderly like that. And so we're applying an enormous amount of resources and energy to try to keep this kind of false order, this really disordered organization is the way that I look at it. And we kind of hold things steady with a huge amount of energy, and the minute we turn our backs, they fall apart. Really what you want to be doing to live more ecologically is determine what the natural kind of configuration of things are. What state do things really want to be in, and help them get there as quickly as possible so that the tendency would be, what we'd like, again, looking at landscape, we'd like the natural state of our yard to be fertile soil and lots of moisture and, abundant and lots of food. So how can we design things to be like that? Or our organizations, we want them to be naturally, democratic and naturally to be able to hear everyone's voice. So how can we create organizations that would naturally do these things? And that's what a lot of the permaculture principles are geared towards, is creating places and systems and gardens and organizations that naturally allow for diversity and productivity and all of that, instead of having to kind of force them to be that way.
While you were talking right there, I was trying to think of something in nature that consistently is a straight line, and the only thing I could think of was sunlight.
Right, yeah.
Right, because sunlight moves in a straight line until it's either stopped, reflected, or I guess that's kind of the options, isn't it?
Right. Well, it gets curved by large gravitational bodies as well. So.
Yeah, that doesn't happen so much on the actual surface of the planet,
right.
I don't think.
No, light goes, it takes a straight line usually.
Okay, so I live in the city, you live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And you out there also probably live in the city, or at least you know someone who lives in the city. So seeing as we mostly live in an urban habitat and the sound of my voice, how do we use some of these principles, assuming we live either in a single family house or a shared house like I do on a 50 by 100 or smaller lot, possibly with not great access to sunlight for growing things. So, what are some simple things that folks could do to kind of begin to incorporate permaculture principles into their environment?
Right. Well, I'd actually like to tell a little story that I think will illustrate some of that. When I lived in Southern Oregon, we had 10 acres and I was able to have lots of room to grow all my favorite plants and have big ponds and all that sort of thing. And when we moved to the city, I looked at my little 50 by 100 lot and said, how am I going to fit all that stuff in this little yard? How am I going to fit even all my favorite fruit trees in this little yard?
And where's the pond
going
to go?
And where's the pond going? And, you know, and all that sort of thing. And we had one fruit tree in our yard, a plum tree. But a few days after we moved in, my neighbor from across the fence called over to me, "Hey, Toby, do you like figs?" And I told him, "Sure." And so for days afterwards, these buckets of figs would come over the fence from Johnny's yard. And then I thought I'd kind of repay the favor to another neighbor, and I took some plums over across the street to my neighbor's Teresa's house. And she said, "Oh, you know, I've already got a plum tree. I don't really need any plums, but we've got a Granny Smith apple, and when that comes on, I'm going to need a lot of help harvesting that." And then the neighbor next door to her said, "Yeah, and I've got a big pear tree, and I can't eat all those pears." And this kept happening all around the neighborhood, and I realized I don't need to grow all my own fruit trees. My neighbor's yards are the community orchard. You know, one mature fruit tree has far more food in it than a single person is going to be able to eat. So I just realized all I need to do is grow the things that are not already in my neighborhood, you know, if it's something like an Asian pear and those sorts of things. So it's really about community, you know, learning to know your neighbors, find out who's in your neighborhood and what are their interests and what are they doing. Because, yeah, we have limited resources in our own yard, but I'm really aware of the unbelievable resources that are in the city as a whole. Just there's all this salvage stuff that people put up by the curb. The tree trimming companies are constantly grinding up wood chips, and they're looking for places to get rid of them, so there's abundant mulch. You know, the resource flows, you know, not to mention things like dumpster diving and all the other kind of fringy things that folks like to do. But the resources in the city are staggering, and simply by finding out where they are, and in particular the social resources, the human capital or social capital, getting to know folks and building community really is the key.
A good story, not quite the practical angle I was hoping for. Although the story about, you know, the neighborhood orchard, you don't need to have, you know, three types of apples and four different stone fruit and, you know, a tomato patch and a squash patch, because none of us has the space to do that really in Portland. I know a couple folks who would, but so the idea of sharing permaculture sort of relies, I mean, again, unless you live out remotely, you know, it's tough to do all these things on your own, and it's probably still tough to do all of them on your own, even if you do have the space, because it's a tremendous amount of work, at least initially. So outside of garden, growing plants and such, what could folks in an urban environment do that would incorporate some permaculture principles?
Well, I think just, again, getting to know your neighbors and organizing. You know, we live on a street where there are occasional trucks cutting through, and, you know, I've talked to my neighbors about this, and we've gotten a sign put up that says no trucks on either end. You have to get a certain group of people together in order to be able to do this. You know, one phone call to the city isn't enough, but the city will tell you, you know, get a bunch of people to do this, and we'll go put signs up. So, you know, organizing, taking advantage of all those resources that are really close by. You know, I lived on a 2-mile gravel road with 12 houses on it and became very aware of how many resources were being used to support those 12 families with, you know, 2 miles of telephone cable and 2 miles of power lines and 2 miles of gravel being replenished every year. And where I live now, there are 12 families living on 2 blocks. You know, using far fewer resources in terms of just the infrastructure that it takes to support them. And that really surprised me. I'd always felt that, you know, the country was going to be more sustainable. When things get bad, you know, when the oil runs out or whatever your favorite disaster scenario is, you know, you don't want to be living in the city. You want to be living out where you got land and you can grow your own food. And what I'm seeing is, and I'm also backed up by what happened during the Great Depression, is that when things get bad, people in rural areas actually do worse than people in cities, because whatever resources there are, they actually come to the cities first and then get distributed, because that's where the people are. So, you know, I'm not too worried about the comparison between rural and urban. I think people in cities can do really well in hard times, getting to know one another and creating community groups and neighborhood associations and all the things that Portland is actually very good at compared to a lot of other cities.
I spent some time living out in the country a few years ago and kind of came to that same realization that, you know, unless you have it literally on site where you are, the way we've set society up, at least here in the United States, is stuff does come through the city first to go out to you. And, you know, even it's weird because even resources that I would have thought would have been kind of rural in origination, in fact, did come from the city back out to the country. It may have started rural, but it had to go through the city for whatever sort of, you know, economic system processing it went through, etc. So we've got just a few minutes left here. Can you give us the title of your talk this evening is Gaia's Garden, which just happens to be the title of your book. So will people be able to hear kind of more elaboration on stuff that we are talking about? Will you be talking specifically about gardening? And will it build on last evening's talk about urban permaculture?
Well, actually, the subject of the talk, Gaia's Garden, was just thrown in there because they knew that that was the name of
something.
My book. Right, exactly.
Okay.
That was a place filler. So what I'm going to be talking about is the use of natural patterns as design, as design tools. Nature's figured out how to design a lot of things, and oftentimes when you see, you know, like a bird wing is built like a truss, or, you know, there are many, many examples of nature. Spirals are used to solve certain design problems.
The golden ratio.
The golden ratio, all these wonderful things that nature has figured out. The veins of leaves and the branches of trees are ways of distributing and collecting nutrients. So nature has figured out a lot of patterns to solve design problems, and what I'm going to go into tonight is how natural patterns can be used for human beings to use as design resources.
Pictures?
Oh, yeah, lots and lots of pictures.
Fun,
right?
Graphics.
Attractive
and
slides, that sort of thing.
Maybe some animation?
Mm-hmm, a little bit of animation.
Ooh, all right, cool. So that is this evening at the Sunnyside Environmental School. We're just past halfway. I guess today begins the second half of the Village Building Convergence. 7 p.m. tonight. Sunnyside Environmental School, 3421 Southeast Salmon. You can catch Toby Hemingway and Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy, I don't know if this is the title of his book or if what he'll be talking about, but it's says The Art of Natural Building. And so the pattern notion, is this sort of like a biomimicry, to take the title of Janine Benyus's really cool book?
Yeah, it's related to that exactly, that nature has nature's had 3 billion years to figure out a lot of problems, and we could learn a lot just by seeing how nature's done it. She's done it with economy and efficiency, and we can learn a lot from that.
Well, thank you very much for coming into the studio this morning, Toby.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
Toby Hemingway is author of Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture, and his website is www.patternliteracy.com. That's all one word, pattern literacy. Thanks again. So a week from tomorrow, author, researcher Michael Rupert will be here in town, presented by the 9/11 Truth Alliance Portland chapter. He'll be speaking on 9/11 and the politics of peak oil. He will have also a report from the Peak Oil Conference that just finished up over the weekend in Lisbon, Portugal. You can find out more about that event at peakoil.net. Mike Rupert speaking Thursday, June 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Northwest Neighborhood Cultural Center, 1819 Northwest Everett. $10 at the door. This event is co-sponsored by KBOO Community Radio. And Mike Rupert will also be on these very airwaves, 90.7 FM, this Friday morning at 9 o'clock. And with any luck, we'll actually have time enough to have you offer calls to him. And next week, we'll be finishing off the interview with Jeffrey Stone, author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. And that will actually be a solid hour, thanks to Kathleen. If you have any questions or comments, you can send me email at kboo@riseup.net. Regular mail here, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214.